Honey, the power's out.
Flashlight's dead. Can't find batteries.
Hey, neighbors. Want to borrow my Star Patrol spotlight?
That flashlight lights up the whole house.
Watch. The Star Patrol can light up the whole neighborhood. It can illuminate up to a half mile away.
A half mile? That's insanely bright.
And the Turbo Boost increases brightness up to 100%.
Whoa, now that's insanely bright.
With 10 illumination modes, the Star Patrol is a flashlight, spotlight, floodlight, emergency light, and more. And with an ultra-fast USB power bank, you can even charge your phone with it. Plus, the Star Patrol is fully rechargeable and backed by a 100% satisfaction guarantee.
So how do I get one of these Star Patrols?
Go to GetStarPatrol.com and you'll get it with free Turbo Boost, free shipping, and a money-back guarantee. Again, that's GetStarPatrol.com. GetStarPatrol.com.
Hey everyone, hope you had a great week, and what a week it's been, right? Doesn't every week sort of feel like that to you? It does to me. But this week in particular, pretty big week, especially when it comes to news. So I'm excited about talking to you a little bit about it. But I'm going to start this brand new podcast with a brand new segment, a segment that I'd like to launch called Mimosa Moments. Mimosa Moments are moments when you just have to sit back and laugh. An example being, a mimosa moment might be when you spill an entire hot cup of tea all over yourself on a flight from Texas to New Jersey, all over yourself, with 2 hours left in the flight, and your daughter doing acrobatics literally in the seat next to you. Now, this wasn't her fault. It was just a mimosa moment. Hashtag that, mimosa moment. Do you have them? I know I do. And that's exactly what happened to me just yesterday. But we survived, and here we are. Do you think there were some mimosas on Air Force One returning from Singapore this week? Maybe. We know the president doesn't drink alcohol. And of course, there's some debate as to what we should be toasting after this summit. And we'll get to that in a moment. But before we launch into the Singapore summit, I think we've been ignoring a really major story on China. And I'm going to back into this story a little bit. And to do so, I'm first going to take you to Russia. Russia is where the World Cup is happening. One of the big stories of the World Cup has to do with the Iranian team. The team from Iran doesn't have a shoe sponsor. Why is that? Well, Nike, an American company, says it can't supply the team with shoes because of sanctions. And this has caused a little bit of an uproar. And I think we should watch what shoes the Iranian team ends up wearing, because it might give us an idea of what companies or countries will step around the sanctions, pun intended. Will it be China? I don't know. But here's why I'm asking this question. While the world was so focused on the Singapore summit, China was hosting an annual summit. And at that summit was Iran. And Iran and China formed an agreement to continue to work together. It's a little nonspecific. But this is a direct affront, of course, to the United States, who has recently backed out of the Iran nuclear deal. And the timing can't be ignored of all of this, right? At the same time that China is making this agreement with Iran, China is putting back surface-to-air missiles on these contested islands in the South China Sea. Our Secretary of Defense just talked about this, saying that these missiles really are a form of aggression. But despite what he said, China's doing it anyways. So we need to watch China, because China's been sidelined a little bit with the focus on America and North Korea. And China, of course, has a very complicated relationship with its neighbor, North Korea. So there's a lot to watch there. And I don't think we should keep our eye off of that. And we're going to continue to do that on Smarter News. But let's get down to business a little bit. We all know what the big news of the week is, the Singapore summit, the notorious summit, the historic summit, or a summit that some say is lacking in specifics. Here's the fact. An American president, a sitting American president, that's important, a sitting American president has never met face-to-face with a sitting North Korean leader. That is history. But there's still a lot more to this story that we have to watch. So if you read the Smarter summary, you'll see that we played with this theme a little bit. This moment in history can actually be both. It can both be epic and also be lacking. there can also be a lot more to the story. And there's power in the summit actually being both things. So we can leave room for both and not take away with the importance of it. But here's just a friendly reminder, because I know you've heard a lot about this story this week and I don't need to pile on to it. I just want to remind you that nearly 100% of the people speaking about North Korea have never, ever, ever been to that country or ever will. And they include our policymakers, because they can't go. It's not that they don't want to go, but they can't go. And I'm not judging them or their expertise. I've never been to North Korea either. But it's interesting to think about that, and I don't want you to forget about that when you get folks that are talking so confidently about a place that they never have been and never will. Keep that in mind, because several years ago, I spoke to a man, Michael Malice. He had just returned from North Korea. In fact, it was his first interview on Fox News. He had written about his experience in an article on Reason.com, and we discussed what he saw when he was in North Korea. And I will always remember our conversation because he talked to me a little bit about his family's history and how they got to America and why that really motivated him to go to North Korea and continue his research. And so I reached out to him this week, and we talked for about 20 minutes, and you can listen to our interview right after this small news portion if you'd like to and you have time. So stay tuned for that. I think you'll really enjoy it, and he offers a unique perspective that you simply cannot get everywhere. He's actually been there, and then he came back, studied, researched, wrote a book about it, and has a lot of really interesting thoughts. So please take a listen to that. In the meantime, over the last 24 hours, we just received some really big news. The Inspector General of the FBI, a man that's really been praised, by the way, for neutrality and professionalism, just issued a report on the FBI's investigation into Hillary Clinton's emails. And now, and the Inspector General is a watchdog that's within the agency. So this is a really important report. It's more than 500 pages. And you'll see some headlines, including ours on Smarter News, that read something to this effect: errors found at the FBI, but not bias. And that's true. The Inspector General says that there were errors found in the way the FBI handled the investigation into Hillary Clinton's emails, but that bias did not impact that investigation. And that is a crucial, crucial difference. Remember, the Inspector General did not investigate the totality of the FBI and whether or not political bias is impacting the agency. The Inspector General did so in relation to this one investigation. And I haven't read through all 500 plus pages yet, but I did find out that bias is mentioned 120 times in the report. And I went back and read through some of those instances. The Inspector General did not say that there's no bias at the FBI. He just said not in relation to this investigation. And one of the agents that was working on the Hillary Clinton email investigation did make some very damning comments about candidate Trump at the time. That same agent worked on the Russia investigation for a while, is no longer, by the way. But remember that. This Inspector General report, despite all you hear over the next several days and weeks, is very limited. And there are some bigger questions about political bias within the FBI and other federal agencies that it does not answer. So it ain't over, folks. I hate to tell you that. We're going to be hearing a lot more about the FBI political bias. And of course, we're all awaiting the conclusion of Robert Mueller's investigation into Russia and the 2016 election. So a lot more to hear on that. In the meantime, just want to finish on a note on Father's Day. I had no idea that Father's Day dated back to more than 100 years. I really didn't. I think I dismissed it sort of as a Hallmark holiday, no offense to dads, as like a response to Mother's Day. And in fact, it actually is a response to Mother's Day, but it has a very cool story. A sweet daughter of a single dad was really the force behind launching Father's Day as we know it. And we have a great father that works with us at Smarter News. And his name is Ben. Ben is our tech guru. He's also the dad of two. Without Ben, this podcast doesn't get loaded. Without Ben, Smarter News doesn't get launched, period. Without Ben, I think I might go crazy. So Ben is a really big deal for us. And we're so grateful to have him as a part of Smarter News. And if you're listening to this, two things either happen. Either Ben did not listen to this podcast at all, or he followed my wishes to keep this part in, because it's people like Ben that makes Smarter News really special. And I'm so proud to work with him, not only because he's a talent, but because he's a great dad. And I think when you work with great people, you feel it in the company. So thank you, Ben. Happy Father's Day. And happy Father's Day to everyone out there. And thank you for being part of the Smarter News movement. It's an exciting time. There's a lot going on in the world. And remember, when you consider that there's a lot of things happening, you know, the North Korea summit is either the best thing ever, the worst thing ever. You know, the FBI's Inspector General report is either conclusive or not conclusive at all. When all options are on the table, it's affirmation that really anything can happen. And you'll hear in the interview with Michael Malice, hope is really powerful. Hope is a powerful thing. And knowing that anything can happen is actually pretty exciting. So thank you for being part of our adventure here at Smarter News. And we can't wait to talk to you next week. Have a great one, guys. Talk to you then. Hey guys, a quick note on Michael Malice. Michael is a writer and a commentator, and in 2012, he went to North Korea on a tour, sort of like if you went on a tour in Italy, but different. And that sparked his research and work that led to a published book, Dear Reader, the Unauthorized Autobiography of Kim Jong-il. Now, Kim Jong-il is the father of the current North Korean leader, Kim Jong-un. And Michael originally wrote about his trip to North Korea online in an article on Reason.com. And you'll hear us talk a little bit about that article because when I read that article back in 2013, I invited Michael on our show on Fox News, and I've always remembered that conversation. And so when I reached out to him this week, so last minute, I was so grateful when he said he could join us. And I found our conversation just as fascinating now as I did then, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. When did we talk for the first time?
It must have been 2013.
It was right after you published the article about going to North Korea. And
I can tell you now, I have the file somewhere. Let me look, sort by date.
Because
you were the first one, so you need to pat yourself on the back.
Come on. You know what?
I absolutely do.
One of the first interviews you did when you came back, right?
Yeah, it was the first. It was the first time I was on Fox.
That's amazing. And now look at you. A superstar in the making.
I'm a modern day Bill O'Reilly.
I'm going to take some credit for that for sure. But you know, what struck me about the Reason.com article, I mean, there were so many things that struck me, but let's walk through a couple of them for the people that haven't read the article. One is the fact that you went somewhere that we talk a whole lot about, but no one's actually been. And what's remarkable as a news anchor is you speak to all of these really fascinating, well-educated people that spend a lot of time in international affairs that have often never been to the places that they're responsible for advising on, right? So it was really great to speak to someone that actually stepped foot in North Korea. And also, I will never forget the part about your family and how you felt your family's background gave you a unique perspective on looking at North Korea. So why don't we just start there? Because I think it's really interesting background.
Sure.
What is it about your family's background that you think not only motivated you to go to North Korea, but then view it in a certain lens?
Well, and this is something you touched upon when you had me on your show. The thing that struck me is I was born in the Soviet Union and I'm Jewish, and these were two chances for my family to have been in a concentration camp. And thankfully, the concept of concentration camps is gone from this earth largely, but they still remain in North Korea. So going there was my chance to see what it might have been like, you know, 100 years ago for people who were, you know, direct relatives of mine, and to see the people who are amazingly in the 21st century suffering under these same conditions.
Did you see anything like that when you were there?
You don't obviously see the camps, but you can't escape the sight of suffering everywhere you look. I mean, the way people talk, everywhere there's filth. You know, the atmosphere of decay is very hard to convey. It's kind of like a basement, but wherever you go, there's a smell. Wherever I went, there's a fly, which is like a biblical symbol of evil. Every carpet has a stain. Every wall has a crack. And the reason that is if you are there, you can't point out mistakes because then it looks like you're criticizing. So you have to keep your head down and just try to get through the day. So as a result of this, no one is in a capacity to fix things on their own, to like grab a wrench and do something. You have to follow protocol. And why stick your neck out? Because that's when you get a cut.
Literally.
Yes, literally. Yes.
I think we forget that, by the way, because most of us haven't been to North Korea and have
Right.
never seen the violence of the regime. And so it's causing us to really imagine dark things, right? To
Right.
understand what's actually happening inside that country. But you've done a lot of research in your time going and then coming back. I mean, what is your understanding about what's actually happening there that we aren't seeing?
It's almost impossible for a free people to understand what this kind of life is like. I mean, you want to take a trip, you take a trip. You want to change the channel, you change the channel. If you think someone's a jerk at work, you get a new job. None of those options are available to you in North Korea. You always have to worry, who is this person and what are they going to do to me? You always have to be kind of speaking in double talk because at any moment your situation in life is precarious. And North Korea is even more insidious because the great leader Kim Il-sung, who was the founder of North Korea, said class enemies have to be exterminated to 3 generations. So if you do something wrong, your whole family's going to be in trouble. So that's another level of depravity these people have to make sure everyone, toes the line.
And I should mention that since going to North Korea in 2012, this
Yeah.
actually led to some really remarkable work that you put into a book.
Yeah, my book, Dear Reader, I was ecstatic because when I started doing this work in 2012, the perception out there was that North Korea is crazy. And from my perspective, saying someone is crazy just means I don't understand them. Those two things are synonymous. And my point was to be like, also to claim that they're crazy is to give them, deprive them of moral culpability. It's like if someone is insane, they're not really a murderer. No. These people are cold-blooded and vicious and amoral, and they have a systematic, ritualized approach to their dictatorship that has to be understood in order to be defeated.
Wow, that's a lot to take in. But I think that part about moral depravity is absolutely true, right? If someone's insane, then you kind of put them in a different category and you don't expect correct behavior.
Right. Whereas if someone is someone who's intentionally killing children, knowing what they're doing, that is something that's you can't even wrap your head around. You can understand someone losing their mind and going on a spree. It's horrible. It's evil, and no question. And that person is dangerous. But I mean, how much more dangerous is it when this person has no emotion and are doing the worst possible things?
Right, absolutely. Well, that brings up all sorts of questions about the way forward with North Korea, which I want to ask you about as well. But I want to take a step back again and go back to 2012. You decide to link up with this tour company because,
Yeah.
believe it or not, there are tour companies that will take you to North Korea,
Not anymore, but
and
yeah.
not anymore. There were at the time, so you got in just at the right moment, Mike.
Yes.
Right? So, what's your first impression? You land in North Korea. What is your first memory of being there?
When you land, first of all, when you're in the plane, all the stewardesses have those badges. Everyone in North Korea by law has to wear a badge over their heart of one of the leaders. So on the plane, all the stewardesses have the badges of the great leader or the dear leader, Kim Jong Il. So that already is wacky. But when you land, it like every part of your brain is screaming at you like you don't belong here. It's very hard to describe. Like, maybe there's some kinds of music you like, some kinds I like. If you went to a club that really isn't your style, your brain would be like, okay, why am I here? I need to leave. Well, you
Right.
can't. You know what I mean? The whole country is like that. It's not for you. Obviously, it's the most homogenous country on earth, so visually you're standing out. In the airport, there was no like the lights weren't on. I mean, it was a dark hangar. And there was this sense of unease that was very pervasive.
Were you scared?
I was scared at first, but then after a while, you realize it's safer there than here because since you're a guest of the government. You can pretty much, with certain very, tragic exceptions, like with Ottawa Beer, you can do whatever you want because you have dollars, and that those dollars mean more to them than the North Korean lives.
I can't help but think about Otto Wambeer's parents. Of course,
Yeah.
he's the American college student that was imprisoned in North Korea, sent home in a coma,
Yeah.
and died. The North Koreans say, oh, it was botulism
Right.
and something else, but we don't really know, quite frankly, what
Right.
happened to him.
Correct.
And now, just thinking as a mom, watching everything play out on the world stage, I can't imagine what that mother is going through. And one of the things we're doing on Smarter News is I don't want to forget that family because there's truth in every instance, right? Every experience, every story tells you something about the bigger picture, and I don't want to forget that, right? That actually happened.
And as a mom that she told him, "Are you sure you want to do this?
Right.
Are you sure?" She warned him, "Moms worry." And I mean, my heart goes out to her because she will never recover from this.
No.
There's no way.
Right, absolutely. And just a reminder, though, here we are, modern times, an American can be murdered overseas with very little consequence.
Right.
You know, here we do. Oh, of course, there's been rounds of sanctions and all of this, and there's been movement behind the scenes, I'm sure, that we don't know about. However, that happened, and it wasn't, yeah, you know, decades ago. It happened in recent times.
Oh, yeah. Well, they've also done it decades ago, too. They've killed Americans many times in the past.
Precisely, yeah. More than 70 yeah. years, even longer than that. Right, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Let's not go – we have to remember all of the historical context. What is your most salient memory there? So you spent a week. Is it a week that you were there?
Yeah, I was there for a week.
And your most salient memory is what? Like, when you think back on that time, like, what?
I mean, there's so many flashbulb moments. I think the one that drives me the most, and I've told this story many times, when they took us to a school, and the school is fake. And you know it's fake because any school you go to is going to be noisy.
Wait, so it's like walking into like a film set or something?
No,
like
but
that?
It's like an actual building, but there's only the children who are in front of you are making noise. The rest of the school is silent.
Okay.
That's not possible in any school.
100, as a mom, I can also tell you that.
Yeah. Even if the kids are super well behaved, you're going to hear teachers,
yeah,
you know, teaching the classes. So it's totally silent. And these were the kids of the elite, right? So they're adorable. And the little boys are in little soldier suits, like, you know, just cute as can be. And hearing their chest coughs is that sound. You know, you're a mom. When a kid gets a chest cold, you don't think anything. Okay, they're going to be sick. You give medicine. They're fine. Knowing that these are the children of the elite and they can't have medicine strictly because of the government. And, you know, they are suffering in the cold. They don't have warm clothes for no reason whatsoever other than this totalitarian dictatorship is keeping it from them. That really messes with your head. And also knowing the fact that every single person I saw is still there. So think what you've been doing for the last 6 years. Think what I've been doing. They're still in that giant prison.
Right. And so they can't get medicine, just to be clear about that, is simply because there's a lack of business coming into the country, or also because the government is simply in complete control of all consumer goods.
Well, there are no consumer goods per se. So according to North Korean Juche idea, the ideology, it has to be by Koreans and for Koreans. So since North Korea is very bad at producing medicine, you're not allowed to import anything because you don't want contact with the outside world.
It's one thing to go and experience a trip abroad. It's another thing to go and have that experience and then decide, I'm going to learn even more about that. I'm going to write a book about that. And I'm not going to hesitate to do dozens and dozens of interviews on this topic. Obviously, this is something that you've done, Michael, and that's a work of passion. So I'm curious how you went from that trip to then being like, I need to tell part of this story. And what do you think is the part of the story that just your average American needs to know?
Well, the fact that I got out of Russia and these people, again, like I just said, are still there, like I feel like, as pretentious as this sounds, I don't have a right to say, well, that's their problem. You know, I'm the one who got out. So there's some responsibility on me to give these people justice and inform the world what they're like. I mean, the thing that just strikes me the most is how what Americans need to know is how boring these people are. Like, I know refugees, they like, you know, I know one refugee, she's this boring teenage girl. So these people aren't lost. They're not robots. You know, let them have a recliner, eat their chicken, have a beer, watch some terrible TV shows, just like the rest of us. That, you know, they're not special. They're just trapped. So the idea that, you know, that they somehow want to kill America or so on and so forth, they just want food.
It's more basic.
Yeah, it's really that simple. And the only reason they don't have food is because the government doesn't allow it in as a mechanism of controlling them.
What was it like for you to watch President Trump, Ambassador Bolton, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo? Of course, Secretary of State Pompeo has been to North Korea.
Yes.
But no one else really has.
Right.
And you actually spent some time there.
Yes.
I'm just curious what that was like for you. And what you would want to tell our leaders and our policymakers that are going to be making what seems to be, and we don't know yet, some major decisions when it comes to North Korea.
It's like watching maybe like Pee-wee's Big Adventure. It's so surreal. Like I can't even begin to wrap my – if you said, you know, in 2012, in 6 years, President Trump would be shaking hands with Kim Jong-un in Singapore and they'd be patting each other on the back – I wouldn't know what to tell you. I mean, it's so weird on so many levels. What's really sad to me is how people aren't allowing themselves to hope this is going to end in the peaceful liberation of the North Korean people. I mean, we were on the track to war, which is if you want to rattle someone's cage, you have to rattle their cage and get them to change their behavior. They've been locked in for 7 years. The fact that we're in a positive direction And Kim Jong-un has, it seems, at least from his rhetoric, been far more than in the past, bending over backwards to try to accommodate the U.S. and reach a positive direction. And that video President Trump showed them, which is it giving, I don't know if you saw it, it was this 4-minute commercial basically saying, you know, Kim Jong-un, you could be the leader who brings prosperity to your people. What a great victory for you. He's not saying he's not a threat. He wasn't saying I'm going to do something for you. This could be you. You could be the George Washington. It's flattering him. And I think that's the exact note to strike. And if he can transition this country even into the 20th century, I mean, it would just be such a like a beautiful miracle.
It absolutely could be. And I wonder if you'd go back, if that was the case.
Oh, I would go back. Oh, I'd go back in a second. I was thinking, would I go back now when my friend recently went and I saw the pictures and I'm like, I can't deal with this.
Why?
Because it's so hard. Because, again, seeing how they live and knowing they're trapped. And a lot of them know that they're trapped, which makes it even harder.
Did you stay just in Pyongyang when you were there?
No, they took us to the DMZ. They took us to Kaesong as well.
So they took you, they showed you, and Kaesong is what? Part?
It's this city in the south where basically it's very kind of old-timey. You know, they have the pagodas and so on and so forth, old cobblestone streets and things like that.
Did you feel that you were being watched the whole time? Like, if even in a hotel room, did you feel like someone's watching me?
The hotel is segregated by nationality, so the guides are not allowed on our floor. They actually step out of the elevator into a void, this darkness on their floor. There's no light. It was very weird. And the tour group said specifically, you can do whatever you want in your hotel rooms because we, the Western tour people, we have said such horrible things. We know we're not being bugged. And we were barely in the hotel.
Oh my gosh.
In the hotel. We were out the whole time. And you know who was watching us? It was a very benevolent way. When we were going down the street, little kids would look at us out of the corner of their eye, and teenage girls and grandmas. So they were curious. So there wasn't this air of hostility. This was, you know, very human. What's going on here? And they can't approach us and ask by law.
Right, right. That's so different than what I heard. I thought that, and this is just, you know, I can't source this to any one thing, but in my research and doing so many interviews in North Korea, that they were actually taught that, you know, Westerners were scary and evil, and that they would be like scared to look at us, that they wouldn't even, you know, they wouldn't even want to gaze on us.
I'm 5'6", 150. I'm not scaring anyone. So I actually, someone I know smuggled a North Korean soldier's outfit. It fits me perfectly.
Really?
So I guess, I'm like a size large there. So when they see me, think of me as a devil, and to see me, you know, walking along in the designer jeans, it's hard to reconcile those two things.
Just a final question, because I think this is, you know, this was a major, this was at the center of the debate about whether or not this summit was going to happen in Singapore.
Right.
It was about the regime and how the regime in North Korea wanted some sort of guarantee. This was reported that the United States policy would not be to overthrow the regime.
Yeah.
And the fate of the regime is a big question mark. And that's something that we were speaking about before we started this interview. I thought it was a really interesting point that you brought up, which is there's the American promise and then there's the unknown. And I was wondering if you could walk our viewers and our listeners through that.
When these regimes liberalize, often there's a huge uprising and the people at the top are killed with good reason. There's a book in North Korea called The U.S. Imperialists Started the Korean War. And they are taught from birth that the Korean War was launched by us. So when it's been described by refugees that when they learned that the great leader Kim Il-sung started the Korean War, it would be akin to you and I learning that FDR bombed the Japanese at Pearl Harbor. I mean, everything changes in your mind. So to learn that this three-generation family has had concentration camps and are the only reason you're so oppressed, I mean, to convince them to let him stay as a figurehead and not, you know, drag him through the streets, that's going to be a very tricky thing to do.
And that's a really interesting point that I think is it really causes us to listen carefully. We can make promises as a government, but we can't overpromise. I mean, we don't know what's going to happen inside the country. And I wonder how much that's a part of the calculation within our policy circles of we're going to do our part. And then we don't know what's going to happen on the inside of North Korea, but we have certain ideas of what could happen over the next several years or decades. And I wonder how that's figuring in.
And after a certain point, when you take your hands off the wheel, you don't know what's going to happen. Right. So if you liberalize, things have a way of escalating with their own momentum. And, you know, at that point, there's only so much the U.S. can do other than literally have a military coup d'etat there, which no one wants.
Right. Absolutely. Michael, where's your next adventure? I mean, you did the North Korea thing. This is getting you through like a decade of work.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Where's your next place? Where's your next fascination, you think?
In the same way that I made North Korea coherent and sane to the reader, my next book is about the new right. And, you know, I was at Charlottesville. I'm explaining that whole ideology to everybody.
Wow. You want to give us any little like insight, just real quick, like little cliff notes, anything that you learned or want to share? Because you're not, are you not comparing the North Korea regime to the alt-right, are you? Or is that
very much.
Oh, you are? Okay. I was like, I just want to be very transparent about that part of it. Yeah.
North Korea is the most homogenous. It's an ethno-state. It's the most racist country on earth. They say this proudly. But, you know, they make sense what their worldview is. It's easy to dismiss the alt-right and you know, groups like that. But there is a coherence to the ideology. And I, in the same way that I made North Korea humorous to make it palatable, I've done the same thing here.
Interesting. How far along are you on the book?
I just handed the final draft in on Sunday to the editor, St. Martin's.
I know, you know, I don't have the big show anymore on Fox News.
I
can't have the first interview like I did after the Reason.com article on North Korea, but I think we should have a conversation on the book when it comes out. I'm just saying.
You are the first one who got me on Fox News, so you have a blank check to call whenever you like. I'm not joking.
Good. I'm going to write that down just because I might need to. I mean, as an entrepreneur, I might need to cash that in soon. All right, Michael, thank you for making time for us. I really appreciate it. And it's fascinating to hear your perspective. I know you've told the story about North Korea probably about a million times, but I could listen to it all over again. So I really appreciate
it. I'll say it as long as it takes until they're free. Awesome. You know what I mean? That's all it comes down to.
And the fact is, again, that little glimmer of hope that could actually happen is on the table. And we don't want to, you know, you don't want to think too optimistically, but you don't want to be too much of a pessimist either.
Exactly. So I'm very, very hopeful.
Sweet spot. Okay, next interview. We'll get it going. Thanks, Michael. I appreciate it.